This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Father Greg Boyle, is a Jesuit priest who works with Latino gangs in the poorest parish of Los Angeles. As one probation officer once said, Father Greg set the moral tone for a lot of youngsters raised without love and rules. From all reports, even the toughened gang leaders love him as a father figure. But that doesn't mean he's been able to stop the young people from killing each other, although he has helped some of them get out of the gang life. Father Boyle runs a jobs program for gang members and is the former pastor of the Dolores Mission Church. He's the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys, by journalist Celeste Freeman. Boyle is Irish-American from a suburban background. He came to the Dolores Mission in 1986 at the age of 32. It didn't take long to figure out that the members of his church thought one of the community's biggest problems was gangs. But rather than trying to protect churchgoers from the gangs, he decided to focus on working with the gangs.
The realization comes quickly when you're working in a community like that, that these are human beings, that these are the sons and daughters of the people who, you know, come to church on Sunday. And it's not a huge jump and leap to be able to get to the point where you discover that any behavior that they kind of manifest that's kind of antisocial is really symptomatic of a lot of problems that you need to hunker down and address, you know, like poverty or the fact that at the time when I arrived, a lot of these kids weren't in school, so we addressed that pretty immediately. And then jobs and lack of opportunities and the fact that there's sort of a disparity between the schools that have and those that have not, those are the problems. So as you see these kids acting out, you know that they indicate problems. They're not really a problem in themselves. And if you can get to the root of why these kids act this way, then you can, you know, respond humanly and compassionately to them. But I don't really think that's a hard thing. I mean, it never occurred to me ever to treat them like they were the enemy.
What separates one gang from another in the area that you work?
Well, not much. I mean, we have two housing projects, which together represent the largest grouping of public housing west of the Mississippi. And so, though it sounds large, it's a kind of a tiny area geographically. I could walk the whole area in 15 minutes. So within that area, you have eight neighborhoods, eight gangs. So sometimes it's just an area of like two square blocks. That's a gang's territory. So what separates them really is not very much, you know. They're pretty much like situated right next to each other. And of course, they're mirror images of each other. So, I mean, all these kids, at the time when I first came to Dolores Mission, we had one African-American set, a Crip gang, that's no longer there. And now all our gangs are exclusively Latino. So, you know, when they go to shoot their enemy, they're in effect shooting this mirror image of themselves.
What are their fights about?
Boy, it's not about anything that makes sense. It's kids acting out who are, by and large, fatherless, who are unable to imagine a future for themselves, and so their present is never very compelling for them. Mm-hmm. So they tend not to care whether they duck to get out of harm's way or whether they inflict harm on somebody. So you have to kind of give them an infusion of hope that will enable them to conjure up some kind of future for themselves, you know. They look back on their lives and at their parents' lives, if there are any parents around, and they see that joblessness and despair has sort of been a part of the air they've breathed forever, and so they can't imagine that it's going to be much different. So you ask any one of these kids, where will you be in 5 years, and they'll all tell you dead or in jail. So you need to break that kind of lack of imagination.
So what do you do to give them hope, and how much is the hope that you're offering, a kind of religious hope, how much are you likely to talk about Jesus as opposed to talking about a job?
Well, I mean, I think I remember once I got disinvited to a kind of a fundamental Christian church. One parishioner had set up a time for me to speak, and then the pastor saw me on TV and said, I don't want him here, because not once in the course of the conversation or the interview on TV did I mention that Jesus was my personal savior. And I thought, well, oh well, you know, I mean, it's sort of Jesus calls us calls us to be thinking, concretely helpful people, not kind of folk who just sort of blather on about Jesus. you know, I want to see kind of concrete compassion lived and demonstrated to these kids. You know, in the end, you ask any person who works with these kids and then have them trace back their success stories, you know, kids who've matured out of gangs. And I suspect every single one, from teacher to probation officer, will say that the one thing that each one of those success stories had in common was at least one caring adult who paid attention. 10 would be great, but you have to have one. And whereas I believe strongly in employment as a concrete sort of example and infusion of hope, you know, you really need to have kind of adults who show up in these kids' lives. That's really, there's nothing quite like it in terms of communicating in the clearest of terms, you know, a hope for a kid who can't really, who's gotten stuck somewhere, you know.
So do you see that as your main job in a way, to be one of those reliable adults who are there and who cares?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it's not just myself, of course, but our entire community and all the adults there, mainly women, because there aren't many men, frankly, who live in the projects. And the women, you know, have kind of embraced fully the African adage, the entire village raises the child. So these aren't some monsters who are kind of running around wreaking havoc. These are our sons who are in trouble. And so, you know, we will communicate to them as clearly as we can that we care for them and that we pay attention and that we'll do all that we can to help them. And if you could bottle that, you know, and I mean, if Contract on America or For America or whatever had that as what part of its tenet, it certainly would do more to kind of curb crime, especially among youth, than just about anything else, because part of even our whole policy on crime in this country is built upon the deterrence principle that you can kind of scare a kid straight, that if a kid fully recognizes that he or she will be locked up in prison forever or worse, that will kind of deter them from crime. But of course, if the issue is here are kids who have stopped caring, then what difference does it make? You can't hurt them, you can't outbad them, you can't threaten to do anything to them that they haven't really known. They just don't care. So if you're despondent, I mean, you know, hope is about the only antidote that I know of.
So what do you give in addition to your presence as an example of hope?
Well, I mean, I think in our parish community, we have an alternative school for junior high and high school kids, all at risk, all gang-impacted youth. We have two mentor programs. We have my jobs program, of which we have Homeboy Industries, which is a trying economic development branch of it, where we try to create jobs, not just wait for employers to see the light and hire the kids. So we have Homeboy Bakery, Homeboy Merchandising, and Homeboy Silkscreen. These are the kinds of things that we try to kind of in an institutional, formal way communicate to these kids that we are with you.
So you're almost like creating a little arts and business community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And these are kinds of concrete manifestations of hope, but coupled with adults who have it together, you know, and who basically can grab these kids by the hand, walk them into a future that they're unable to imagine for themselves, all the while telling them, you know, I can see your future. You just can't see it. It doesn't mean you don't have one. It just means you can't see it right now. And we'll walk them into their future until such time as they can see it for themselves, and then they're on their own, you know, and then you can move to the next kid.
My guest is Father Greg Boyle. He's a Jesuit priest who works with gangs in East L.A. He's the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Father Greg Boyle, who has a gang ministry in Los Angeles. Did the people in the gangs who you were trying to understand and win over, did they test you when you first started working with gang members, test you to see if you were brave, test you to see how you'd react around guns or how you'd react to the knowledge that they had guns?
I guess they did. You know, it's hard to reconstruct all that. It feels like a long time ago. But, I'd walk in the projects and they see a white guy, and even if they knew I was the priest, that doesn't give you kind of immediate entree to them. You know, they still think Many of them have this tattoo on that's sort of in, I think, Chinese lettering. And it means trust no one. And virtually many of them have this tattoo. And so I certainly fell into that category as somebody who, you know, you wouldn't naturally trust. And then, you know, just little by little, I started to gain their trust, I guess. I started to visit them at juvenile hall or in the hospital when they were shot. I'd bring back word from their homeboy who was locked up. And then it became this kind of, you were okay, you know. And then I think that's when we sort of opened our alternative school, and it led to a kind of a trust.
Was it important in a way to prove that you were brave, since bravery is, I'd imagine, really important within gangs?
Well, you know, I always find that you have to kind of take their principles and kind of walk through their door and make sure you come out another door, you know. Like for gang members, if you're down, that's the highest value there is, you know. Are you down to kill, basically, you know? I remember a kid once who was went to the cemetery after about a month anniversary. A kid had been killed, and we were all standing there and around the grave, and this one kid just starts to sob like a baby. And it's really kind of bothering his other homeboys. There were about 30 of us there, and I pull him aside, and I said, "What happened? What's wrong?" Well, it turns out the kid who had been killed had told him the day he was had been shot earlier in the day, said, "I have a premonition I'm going to get killed, but I know that if anything happens to me, you'll take care of everything." Well, this means only one thing in gang parlance. That means that you'll take revenge. You'll kill the guy who killed you. So here this kid had for a month been living with the voice of his dead homeboy whispering in his ear, "Take care of everything. I know you're down enough to take care of everything." And so I can remember telling him, "Oh gosh, you know, you did take care of everything. You raised the money for the car wash. You kept all your homies kind of calm when they wanted to be a knucklehead and go do something. You were really there in a significant way to this, your homeboy's mom and sister." I said, "You know what? You're the downest vato I've ever met." Well, now there's a concept, you know, that, like you say, being brave or being down or being faithful, or it means only one thing in sort of the gang world. If you can take it as a quality and kind of turn it inside out, you know, the kids respond. They nod, they say, they get it, you know, they get it. But you have to kind of lead them to it sometimes.
So do you find yourself doing that a lot, kind of like you know, changing the idea of, say, what it means to be a man?
Exactly. You know, I always tell them, you know, nobody becomes a man, you know, when you turn 18 or 21, or, you know, we all know. I always tell them, we all know vatos who are 40 years old, and it hasn't occurred to them, you know, to be a man yet. You know, being a man is a decision you will make. I saw a kid who was 21 years old. He was working on one of my construction crews, and he was writing on the walls. And I pulled up behind, and all his homies they're clearing their throats, you know, to kind of indicate that I'm there watching. And finally, he drops the can. He sees me, and he comes over to the car. And somebody had given me a $100 bill for our homeless project. And I held it out to him. I said, "This is yours. This $100 bill is yours if you can answer this question correctly." And he goes, "Sure." And I said, "Name a man who writes on walls, you know." And of course, he was stumped. But see, part of the thing is, you know, and this was a kid who has since been killed. But it was a kid who was trying to grow up, you know, and yet you want to kind of hold out to them always, this is what it means to be an adult. And I always tell them, I've never met a man who gangbangs. And now gangbanging is that activity that ranges from writing on the walls at the low end to shooting people and anything in between. You know, you can be a gang member, but have decided not to bang. So it's really gangbanging that I kind of work against. You know, as long as they can hang up their gloves on that score, you know, I'm happy.
Father Greg Boyle is my guest. He has a ministry in Los Angeles that works with gangs, and he's the subject of a new book called Father Greg and the Homeboys. Throughout your years in L.A., you've tried to find as many jobs as you could for gang members, and in fact, you've actually created a lot of jobs, not only in the ministries that you're doing now, you know, in the bakery that you created in the silk screening project, but before that, you'd even, you know, hire gang members to work in the church. How responsible have you found gang members to be? Is that something you've worried about a lot? Will they really show up? Will they take the job seriously?
Well, I mean, it's a constant battle. I mean, these are not perfect folks, and they need to be brought along. You know, I'm always extremely pleased to meet the employer who kind of gets it, who knows that when they hire this homie, they're going to kind of walk them through an experience that's completely foreign to them, showing up on time and being able to take orders and, you know, completing tasks and that kind of thing. So when I went to my mechanic once to hire a kid who was a real knucklehead, who hanging, banging, and slanging, you know, slanging is selling crack, and he was doing it all, but he wanted to be a mechanic, and I went to my mechanic, and I just tried to convince him to hire this kid, you know, and I gave it my best shot, and it seemed like I was making no headway at all with this guy. But finally, the only thing he said to me, my mechanic, was, I'll teach him everything I know. And that was 4 years ago, and this kid is still working there and has been able to rent an apartment, and he has his lady and his baby and pays bills, and I suspect has never been a perfect worker, you know. But when I was on a sabbatical and somebody sent me a picture of my mechanic with this kid, little Danny, they called him, there's no doubt in anybody's mind to look on the kid's face that his life had been altered completely, but equally no doubt that my mechanic's life had changed, you know. That by giving this kid an opportunity and carving out a niche for him and helping him to imagine a future that he couldn't prior to that is a greatly satisfying thing. So, I mean, they're forever not showing up on time or disappointing, and it's hard. You know, you have to kind of bring the employers along and convince them, as I'm utterly convinced, that this is truly part of what's going to solve a lot of what ails us in the inner city.
What about the kids that don't work out so well? Do you feel that the employers are often taking risks to bring them on? Risks maybe, this is what the fear would be, risks of being robbed or, you know, cheated in some small way, or of just someone not being responsible enough to take the job seriously?
Yeah, I think there are no risks. I really believe that, only because I know these kids, you know. I sent a kid to a job, and it was a sure thing, and 3 weeks later, the kid hadn't been called, and so I called the employer, and I said, boy, what happened? You know, I thought we had lined this up, and he said, yeah, you know, but Father, this kid came with really baggy pants, you know, and so I'm thinking to myself, you know, hire him, and he'll buy some Dockers or something, you know, and then he says to me, and the other thing, the kid walked through the office, and we have all this equipment and computers, and he says, turns to the manager and says, boy, this stuff must have really cost a lot of money. Well, of course, the manager reads this as, you know, homeboy casing the joint, you know, and which is completely not even in the realm of the possible, really. You know, this is a kid who was just so badly wanted a job and wanted a ticket out of the world in which he found himself in. So, I mean, it's always a question of educating the employer and educating the public in general. It's pretty clear that if you think these kids are monsters, then it's equally and abundantly clear what we're supposed to do. You know, you have three strikes and you're out, and build more prisons and lock them up, throw away the key, try juveniles as adults, you know, extend the death penalty to include jaywalking. I don't know. This is what you do if these kids are less than human. But if you really maintain that they're, in fact, human and really interesting and filled with great possibility, then there's an equally complex set of solutions that you really have to address, and that's the kind of stuff that works.
When you when you've hired kids from gangs to work for you in one of the programs that you've created or in the church, have you been a strict boss?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, I think part of the thing is they hate to disappoint me. It's one of those, I think those things as a parent, you love to get to that point, you know. So they'll do their best, but sometimes a lot of it is, you know, we learn what it is to show up on time. And I had one of the homies who works at the bakery who had sort of a sore throat yesterday, and He said, I don't think I'll go in. I said, I'm sorry, you know, you're going in, you know. Everybody goes to work with a scratchy throat, you know. You know, unless you have to get checked into the hospital. But these are things that, you know, we all learn somewhere along the way, and these kids didn't.
A lot of people have an attitude of, well, look, if these kids need jobs and they need the money, let them get jobs. What's the problem? What is the problem?
Well, I mean, again, it's sort of degree of difficulty. You know, it's what I used to always call the McDonald's factor. You know, people would say, there's McDonald's, what's stopping them to go and fill out an application like any kid? It's if you understand what this is about, and if you understand that there is a pervasive despair that's crippling and paralyzing, and literally kids are stuck. They're just standing right there, and they can't move. And if you understand that without sort of judging it harshly, and just understand that it's symptomatic of the difficulties of their lives and the kind of, again, the degree of difficulty that it takes in them getting on with their life, then you won't mind sort of grabbing them by the hand and getting on the bus with them to show them how to get to that job. And the next day they'll be able to do it, you know. I grew up in L.A. I have both parents, you know, 8 brothers and sisters all together. We lived fairly okay and comfortably. There was no chance that I ever would have joined a gang. I wouldn't have known where to find one. I wouldn't have known what one looked like if somebody had pointed one out. That fact doesn't make me morally superior to the kids who grow up in the projects where I work. You know, we all have an experience of adolescence and the nightmare of peer pressure and all that kind of difficulty in growing up. But you multiply it by 1,000 and you're not even close to kind of how difficult it is for these kids to enter adulthood.
Father Greg Boyle works with gangs in East L.A. at the Dolores Mission. He's the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys, by Celeste Freeman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Greg Boyle will be back with us in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest who's worked with gangs in East L.A. since 1986. He works in L.A.'s poorest parish, one of the city's most violent neighborhoods. Boyle is the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys, by journalist Celeste Freeman. How many young people have been killed since you started working with gangs? People who you know, people who you work with.
Well, 2 weeks ago, I buried my 49th kid killed in this mess, yeah.
I know that you say the reason for these things is not logical, but what are some of the reasons behind some of the murders of the people who you've lost?
Well, you know, I think there was a time I used to say that in this country, probably in the last 20 years, you know, ministers and priests would tell you that they've had to bury kids, teenagers, who've taken their own lives, you know. And I never had to do that until this past year, where I had to bury actually 2 kids who killed themselves. But prior to that, you know, in many ways, it's true of all 49 kids that I've buried. They're kids who, this has always been sort of the acceptable way of taking your own life. You know, you put yourself in harm's way, you walk into the most dangerous kind of situation, and you hope that you won't come out alive. You know, of all the 49 kids I've buried, and as they filed down the middle aisle of our tiny little church and they view the dead homie in the casket and they go out to the parking lot, I always go to the kid who's off by himself or herself, and I think, well, here's my window of opportunity. There's a chance that the kid is vulnerable and maybe we'll hear something. And I go up to the kid and I almost always say the same thing. I always say, you know, mijo, I never want to see you lying in a casket at 15 or 16 or whatever his age might be. And I suspect that we would all expect a kid to tell us, yeah, you know, that makes 2 of us. I don't want to die. But, you know, Terry, I've never had a kid say that to me, not once, not even close. And for me, what's doubly eerie is that they always say one of 2 things, always, and it never varies. They always say, you have to die sometime, or they'll say, why not? again, both are indicators of a despair that's pretty deep. So, you know, is there a reason for this? There's not a thing you can point to except for the fact that there is a thing out there that's threatening our young people who live in the inner city and who are in kind of an up-against economic situation, and that's despair.
Have you given a lot of eulogies at funerals?
Too many, 49, you know, and I, you know, there's a sameness to it in a way, and there's a kind of a ritual to it. And we had a recent one. We had four deaths in a three-week period, which is a lot. But the fourth one was a 15-year-old who had just recently gotten jumped into a gang. And so the ritual began the day after his death. The homies organized the car wash. There's a sameness to it. They have the big signs. They flag the cars down and they wash them. And then at the end of the day, the homies gave a can of money from their first day's earnings to the mother of this kid. And the mother, without any bitterness or really resentment, refused to take the can and said, you know, I could never take anything from you, you know, because if it weren't for you, really, you know, my son would be alive today. So the woman had this, the funeral in secret somewhere. I didn't go. She didn't inform anybody, and nor any of the homies. Actually, it's a gang that comes to the projects, but she lived outside the projects, so she wasn't really even from our community, nor was the kid. But it was a thing that I hadn't seen ever happen, where a mother kind of made that connection, and it was the best thing that could have happened to these kids, you know? It was better than a eulogy I could ever have given.
Why?
Well, because it was a wake-up call, you know? It kind of broke this cycle and the kind of ritual sameness of bringing kids together to bury yet another young Rasa killed on our streets. And so it was the equivalent of cold water in the face to this one neighborhood, to this one gang. I think it made them think, you know.
We know how angry that mother was. Well, angry isn't exactly, I guess, the right word, but that mother's feelings of, I can't take anything from you.
Mm-hmm.
If it weren't for you, my son would be alive. What prevents you from having that attitude? I mean, you love the kids who are both the killers and the killed. What prevents you from, I mean, what makes it possible for you to still love the kids who you know are responsible for some of the killings?
Yeah, it's a hard one. And you know, things change and things are always fluid for you. You know, I think three deaths back, a kid who was 13 years old, not involved in gangs, and but he happened to be there, and his older brother is from a gang, and his older brother was the target. But it was the younger brother that got killed, you know, and I love that kid, and I love the kid who killed him, you know. But and I guess what got me angry at that one, I can remember myself feeling rage, and I don't think I'd felt anything quite like it in all my years. You know, it was just a blindness and a denial of everybody's complicity from the homie on the side of the kid who got killed to the homies that killed to the people who hide guns in the projects. You know, there was a lot of blood to go around, and it was on a lot of people's hands. I'm okay when people can say, gee, you know, I feel terrible about what I've done or my part in it. But I have to admit, I felt some kind of rage at the lack of that this last time, you know.
So what did you do with the rage that you felt?
Well, you know, I don't know. You have to kind of hold that stuff in check, you know, and dole it out in bite-sized pieces, you know. You don't want to just unleash rage on people, but you let people know. I never want to sacrifice the truth, and that's a kind of a thing I'm into lately, you know. Like three kids did a foray into an enemy territory, and one of the kids didn't come back alive. This was 2 days before we were about to sign a peace treaty. Well, the kids on the side of the homie who was killed, you know, they were just enraged that he had been killed by their enemy. And I want to say, wow, I said, here's one more thing all you guys have in common, you know. Your enemy killed this kid, and the kids who brought him into enemy territory, just as we were about to sign a peace treaty and sabotage the whole thing, they also are responsible for this death. He'd be alive today if it weren't for them. And so I felt I needed to say that at the funeral. I needed to say that to them clearly. They didn't like it, you know. But I can't sacrifice the truth because then, you know, we all lose.
So what happened with the truce?
Well, it's on hold right now. I mean, we had a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old killed, and then it, as depressing as that was, in the middle of the day, one day after the next, it galvanized a kind of a momentum among the women and then among the homies to consider a truce. So there was a lot of shuttle diplomacy going on, and I'd go back and forth, and we met separately with them. We explained, we know that this is hard for you to do, but we know that in our hearts and in your hearts, this is what you deeply want, so we're going to do it for you. So we handed them a peace pact that basically had three parts: do not encroach on somebody else's neighborhood, cease fire, and that anybody who broke or violated those two rules would be corded out of their neighborhood. And when you're corded out, you're beaten down for an indeterminate amount of time until you can't walk anymore, really. And that would be the consequences. And so we had set a time. We were about 2 days away from it. And it was sort of the equivalent of when somebody blows up a bus in the Middle East just when they're about to sign an important peace treaty. It just, there was an element. There were a small group of kids who, I guess, were so despondent that they couldn't see their way clear to really allow for an end to this. But I'm convinced that by and large everybody wanted it deep down. You have to kind of scratch a lot to get there, but it's there. So we're going to revisit it again, you know.
My guest is Father Greg Boyle. He works with gangs in East L.A. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Father Greg Boyle, and he has a ministry in Los Angeles that works with gangs. He's a Jesuit priest. There's a new book about him called Father Greg and the Homeboys. Say you know one of the kids is doing something illegal, or you see them with a gun. Do you feel it's your responsibility to take away the gun or to report something that you know is about to happen to the police?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this one I always get asked, and yet I don't really see how hard it is to kind of grasp in a way, but it always seems to be for people. You know, I virtually know everybody who's killed everybody, you know, in the projects, you know. And I do everything I can in terms of talking to the kid and saying, I always tell them who dies first, you know, the one who gets the bullet or the one who pulls the trigger. And whether they get it or not, I always tell them the one who pulls the trigger dies first, you know. And yet your only chance and hope really is to take ownership for this terrible thing you've done and let me walk with you to the police station. Some kids have done that with me. Most don't. But beyond that, there's not much I can do, you know. Obviously, if I see that something's going to come down, I put myself in the middle of it and it doesn't happen. Or, you know, if I find a gun, it's mine. There's no way I'm going to give that back.
But if you find it on somebody?
Well, I mean, if I know a kid has a gun and, you know, I've gotten into this before where I'll, you know, try to have the kid give it to me. There are a lot of kind of pressures involved in that. You know, a lot of times it's not their gun or it's the gang's gun or the fear of being ostracized by the gang for losing a gun is always great. And, you know, you do what you can, you know. But there's not a lot of anguish that I've ever gone through in terms of, oh God, you know, I know this and I should really do something about it, you know. If I know something's going to come down and it's going to be huge, and I make sure that there are enough police in the area so it doesn't happen, if it's something that I, you know, can get over to, and sometimes if my presence there, will they're not going to do anything while I'm there, and then it'll send them home for the moment, you know. So I don't know. It's not that hard of a, there's not a lot of conflict in that for me. I'm always clear about what I say and what I do, you know.
Have you been shot at much yourself?
Oh, well, I've never taken it personally, but yeah. You know,
you've never taken it personally.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the middle of shootouts, you know, where I'm late at night, and about maybe 8 times, I guess, where, you know, in the darkness and you're standing there or sitting there, or I was on my bike or I was in my car, or and then all of a sudden, you know, the shooting will begin, and you, like anybody, you're ducking behind cars. I've had it happen 3 times, you know, a curious thing. All 3 times, I've had homeboys throw themselves on top of me, you know. Once in a car, I was at the driver's side. And then twice out on the street when big major shootings happened, and I was right in la bola, as we say, right in the middle of all of them. And kids will throw me to the ground and just sort of try to cover my body with theirs, you know.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I was just sort of thinking of that, but I hadn't. But, you know, it's not one of those, you know, they're obviously shooting at me or something.
Right, right.
Or, I mean, in all cases, they never knew that I was there. And when I knew who was shooting and I could go to them the next day, you know, they were plenty apologetic, to say the least.
How do they explain it to you?
Well, they don't explain anything, you know. They just say dispensa, which means sorry.
Right.
Dispensa.
My guest is Father Greg Boyle, who works with gangs in East L.A. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest who works with gangs in East L.A. He's the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys. You said something in the book about you that really reached me. You said that you were finding there was no time to pray. This is something I'd also heard from a minister who I just really, really respect, who his ministry is working with people who he feels are unjustly accused and are on death row or serving life sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And he said at some point in his life he found like he was so busy trying to save the next person that there was no time to pray. And that was that had become at one point a real crisis in his life. How did you deal with that in your life?
Well, I finished my 6 years as pastor, and then I took a year off, which is kind of a proscribed year for Jesuits. It's called tertianship, and you make the hallmark of that year off is you make a 30-day silent retreat, and you do it twice in your life as a Jesuit, once as a novice, and then once again at this designated year. And so it was a life-changing experience for me, really. And I would suspect that I haven't had that problem since I've returned, you know. You start to put first things recognizably first in your life, and I don't save anybody. You know, I'm called to kind of love with the kind of love that that God has, you know, who loves without measure and without regret. And you kind of communicate a no matter whatness to these kids, you know. No matter what, you know, you're always going to be there. No matter what, you know, nothing will force me to withdraw love, you know. And so prayer is the kind of thing that puts all that in its right perspective, you know. So I'm different than I was back in the days when you were kind of frantically trying to save the world and save kids. You know, it's just kind of it enables you to go to sleep at night and kind of say, you know, all this in the end is in somebody else's hands, really. You know, you can only do what you can do. And like with most kids, you can kind of walk them to the door, clearly marked adulthood or safety or maturity out of gangs. And I can walk them right to that door, but I can't, you know, walk through the door for them, you know. Only they can do it. And so you hope and pray they will, and you do all you can to get them inches closer to the door.
After the year that you took for, you know, as a spiritual retreat, which is something that I think is required or expected, mm-hmm. of Jesuits, you were transferred by your church to another ministry, although you really wanted to stay with the gangs that you'd been working with, and they really wanted you back. It must have been a really difficult period for you. I think because of the pressure on the church from people in the neighborhood and everything, you were finally reassigned back to it. But it must have been quite a conflict to decide whether your loyalty was more to the church or to the young people you worked with?
No, it wasn't a conflict on that order, you know. I mean, it was clear I'm a Jesuit first, and I go wherever I'm sent, you know. I was actually never reassigned anywhere. I was just told I couldn't go back. And then, you know, we had a change of provincial, and there was kind of a change of thought on it. And for a time, I worked as a chaplain at Folsom Prison. But, you know, there was never a conflict about, boy, what do I do? You know, I've been told not to go back. I mean, there's no conflict there. I don't go back, you know. But I was always clear about representing my heart, and I feel like I'm not a stranger to my heart, and I can say and articulate kind of where I feel I'm called to be. And once a provincial has heard that and decides not to send me there, then I'm ready for my next assignment. Mm-hmm. I mean, on that, I'm pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. So you're probably starting to see the children of the children who you first saw when you got there in 1986.
Yeah, you know, obviously, one of the symptomatic things out here is that we have kids having kids. And so, you know, I'm forever baptizing, you know, the little kids, you know. But you do see kind of generations moving up, you know. And, you know, is it worse now than it was before? You know, some days yes and some days no. And but you have to just keep at it, you know, and it's worth doing. And it's the approach, I think, is good and correct and true. And it's somebody else's concern whether anything is effective, you know. As long as what you're doing is faithful, you know, effectiveness is fortunately not my concern, really.
Father Greg Boyle, he works with gangs in East L.A. at the Dolores Mission. He's the subject of the new book, Father Greg and the Homeboys, by Celeste Freeman.